House bills on first reading. House Bill 285, first reading of the bill.
House Bill number 285, sponsored by Representative Gingery, mandatory minimum sentence for sexual abuse of a minor and act relating to crimes and offenses. Passed the House on third reading, ayes 53, noes 1, excused 1.
House Bill 285 has been referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary. House Bill 173, first reading of the bill.
House Bill number 173, sponsored by Representative McKim, Teacher Shortage Loan Repayment Program, an act relating to the Wyoming Teacher Shortage Loan Repayment Program. Passed the House on third reading, ayes 58, noes 1, excused 1.
House Bill 173 have been referred to Committee Number 4, Education. House Bill 75, first reading of the bill.
House Bill number 75, sponsored by Representative Brown, Subdivisions, Water Supply Study, and Act Relating to Subdivisions. Passed the House on third reading, ayes 58, excused 2.
House Bill 75 have been referred to Committee Number 5, Agriculture. House Bill 134, first reading of the bill.
House Bill number 134, sponsored by the Select Natural Resources Committee, Natural Resource Large Project Funding, and Act Relating to the Wyoming Wildlife and Natural Resource Funding Act. Passed the House on third reading, ayes 54, noes 4, excused 1, conflict 1.
House Bill 134 have been referred to Committee Number 6, Travel. House Bill 104, first reading of the bill.
House Bill number 104, sponsored by Representative Lubnow, Special District Elections, Polling Place Requirements, and Act Relating to Elections. Passed the House on third reading, ayes 57, noes 1, excused 2.
House Bill 104 have been referred to Committee Number 7, Corporations. Reports from standing committees.
February the 4th, 2009, Mr. President, your Committee Number 2, Appropriations, to whom was referred Senate File 119, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. I, Senators Massey, Meyer, Nicholas, Peterson, and Townsend, Senator Nicholas, Chairman.
Considerations of bills in general file. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, we are at that order of business. Considerations of bills in general file.
Mr. President, I move that the Senate resolve itself back into the Committee of the Whole.
You've heard the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion passed. Senator Schiffer.
The Committee of the Whole will please come to order. The first bill for our consideration is Senate Joint Resolution Number 4. Would the reading clerk please read in the resolution?
Senate Joint Resolution 4, sponsored by Senator Anderson, Black-tailed Prairie Dog, a joint resolution expressing Wyoming's opposition to inclusion of the black-tailed prairie dog on the list of candidate species to be considered for listing as a threatened or endangered species under the Endangered Species Act of 1973. It was referred to Committee Number 5, Agriculture, Public Lands, and Water Resources. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Bebout, Geis, Jennings, Johnson, and Vasey. Senator Geis, Chairman.
Senator Geis. Mr. Chairman, when the Committee of the Whole rise and report, I move that Senate Joint Resolution 4 do pass, and I'd like to move the standing committee amendments. You have it read in.
Senate Joint Resolution 4, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 1, line 13 through 15.
Mr. Chairman, I would move the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 on SJR 4, and I'll yield the floor to Senator Anderson.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, this Senate Joint Resolution Number 4 title says it has to do with a black-tailed prairie dog. That's in the singular. Rest assured, they are in the plural. There are many prairie dogs out there. This resolution, this joint resolution, comes to you at the request of a constituent who has a ranch and other interests near the Black Thunder Grazing Association or the grazing lands or the grasslands at the edge of the Powder River Basin. Mr. Chairman, I find that many of our constituents are really quite frustrated in regard to some of the actions being brought forth by the federal government, and I won't go into a long dissertation in regard to some of the frustrations that we've found ourselves in Wyoming in regard to endangered species, and I could give a long list, and it would be a familiar list, and I won't do that. Mr. Chairman, what this joint resolution expresses is our opposition to the inclusion of the black-tailed prairie dog on the list of candidate species to be considered for listing as a threatened species. Mr. Chairman, the First Amendment is really, or the First Amendment to the bill, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to the Senate Joint Resolution Number 4 has already been moved. But some of the things that are in that amendment are particular to the information that we have in regard to prairie dog populations and infestations. Mr. Chairman, this resolution or this request for this resolution came just hours before the deadline that we had for submitting bills to LSO. So what you have before you was a resolution that I was able to locate that was drawn up some time ago by a now-departed House member from Goshen County that was very active in his efforts in order to control and manage prairie dogs and grasshoppers and other things. So given the time limits and the burden upon staff, I brought that resolution forward. But the amendment that you have before you with information that came after the deadline was what we amended in. And I would like to take a minute to talk about some talking points and the content of that amendment. But the United States Bureau of Fisheries and Wildlife estimated that in 1961, there were about 364,000 acres of black-tailed prairie dogs in the United States. And in 2007, that estimated acreage had increased up to over 2 million. So that shows considerable amount of expansion of their territories. In Wyoming, the agency also estimated that there were about 49,000 acres of black-tailed prairie dogs in 1961. And in 2006, that estimate acreage was up to 2,003, and those figures come to us from the Wyoming Game and Fish Department. The state of Wyoming has worked diligently to keep these species from being listed through statewide efforts to enhance wildlife without interference of the federal government. A listing would preclude management of wildlife species within the state. Prairie dog colonies can reduce carrying capacity for livestock as well as other large grazers, and there's an article here in regard to prairie dogs and the whole story that really bears that evidence out. Studies have shown that prairie dogs change species composition and reduce forage ability by reducing total productivity by replacing preferred forages with unpalatable plants. And ranchers who graze livestock on prairie dog colonies agree that there is less forage available and the vegetation is low quality. If these prairie dogs, Mr. Chairman, are allowed to increase at the rates that we've seen in the past. They're going to present a definite economic hardship upon not only the ranchers, but also they would delay some of the drilling and some of the industrial activity in these areas. So the purpose of this resolution is to provide information to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife in response to the current petition to list the prairie dogs, the black-tailed prairie dogs, that indicate that the black-tailed prairie dog is thriving in Wyoming, and the listing under the Endangered Species Act would be unwarranted. Mr. Chairman, what I've just said is really the essence of the amendment that's been moved that's before you. We added language in page 1, lines 13 through 15, indicating the statistics that I just read to you. The second part of the amendment deals with page 2, line 14 of the bill. We felt that this was probably a more appropriate, a little more contemporary language. And so after page 2, line 14, we would insert finds that the substantial scientific or commercial information demonstrates that the black-tailed prairie dog population has been increasing for the past 4 decades. Mr. Chairman, I would submit to you that I made the statement once that I could walk the full length of my district, which goes from the Natrona County line on the west, the Campbell County line on the north, down to the Laramie County line on the south, and I could practically walk that whole district and step on a prairie dog hill all the way. Well, that's a bit of an exaggeration, but I will submit to you that the black-tailed prairie dog has taken over much of the lands that we find east of the Bighorns, those lands east of the Laramie Range, and would ask at this time that now that the amendment has been moved, that we vote on the amendment. Or I would answer any questions in regard.
The question is on Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate Joint Resolution 4. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. That amendment has passed. Mr. Majority Forward.
Further questions, I would also then call for the question on the Senate Joint Resolution.
The question is on Senator Geis's motion that Senate Joint Resolution Number 4 receive a when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that or do so with a favorable recommendation. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Senate Joint Resolution Number 4 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 127. Would the reading clerk please read in the file?
Senate File Number 127, sponsored by Senator Ross, Junk Dealers, an act relating to junk dealers. It was referred to Committee Number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Bebout, Cooper, Honeycutt, Larson, and Martin. Senator Larson, Chairman.
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move when the Committee of the Whole rise to report they do so with a do pass recommendation on Senate File 127 and that further reading of the bill be dispensed with. Mr. Chairman, there is a standing committee amendment, and I ask that it be read in at this time.
Would the reading clerk please read in Standing Committee Amendment Number 1.
Senate File 127, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 1, line 3.
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move the standing committee amendment, and just a little explanation. We thought we'd done really good work and combined this bill with another one relating to junk. The Senate evidently didn't think so, but this is already passed out. This deals only with beer kegs. And so to explain both the amendment and the bill, I'd like to call on Senator Ross.
Senator Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 127 is a little bill, but it has some big impact for the beer distributing industry, and it pertains solely to kegs of beer. And I passed out for you a handout that had like four pages on it. First was just some talking points. The second page is from a national magazine. The third page is states that regulate beer kegs. And the last two pages are photographs of junk dealers actually here in Wyoming that have purchased beer kegs and then scrapped them out. This bill simply does, and I urge your favorable consideration also of the Standing Committee Amendment, which basically takes out paragraph B on page three of the bill and just leaves the penalty as it stands in the current language under paragraph A. The handouts will show you that, and as I testified to in the previous bill, kegs are owned actually by the distributor or the importer, and they are the property of them. And so that when you're getting into issues about purchasing as a scrap metal dealer kegs, there's nobody other than a distributor, other than the wholesale. I don't even want to say wholesale. The brewery or the importers that own those. So nobody else has a right to own them. They're the property of the brewery, and it's pretty easy to determine whether or not somebody is lawfully has the right to sell those to a scrap metal dealer. What I found compelling about this bill is that it costs the industry over $50 million a year, because the price for scrap metal has gone to over $40 for one of these over the past 3 years. The price of a new keg is about $130. So, when you look at page three of the handout, you'll see that Wyoming is only one of nine states in the country that doesn't have some sort of provision with regards to kegs and their use as scrap metal. And I think it's high time that Wyoming move into that realm also. I mean, the two photographs that I attached to this, are graphic evidence. It was taken by a scrap metal dealer in Loveland of photos here in Wyoming. And you can see that it's not a small little business. So all this does is say that you shouldn't knowingly purchase or possess on your premises as a junk dealer any of these things, any of these kegs. That's a very limited bill. Penalty's not very severe, but certainly I think that the problem with the previous bill was all the reporting and documentation requirements that were required in that bill, at least it's my perception after hearing the debate on the floor, was the real reasons or the real problems with that bill. This doesn't have any of that in it. It simply just says you can't do this. And I'd urge your favorable consideration of the Standing Committee Amendment and the bill.
Question is on Standing Committee Amendment number 1 to Senate File 127. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Standing Committee Amendment number 1 has passed. We're back on the bill. Question being called for. All those in favor of Senator Larson's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rise to report, it do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 27. Please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay. Senate File 127 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Next bill for consideration is Senate File 108. Would the reading clerk please read in the bill?
Senate File number 108, sponsored by Senator Bebout, Long-Term Care Facilities, an act relating to the Wyoming Business Council. It was referred to Committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, that reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Hastert, Honeycutt, Landon, Schiffer. No, Senator Scott, Chairman. It was re-referred to committee number two, Appropriations. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Massey, Meyer, Nicholas, Peterson, and Townsend. Senator Nicholas, Chairman.
And I need somebody who... Senator Scott, I'm glad to see you stand up.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I move when the Committee of the Whole rise and report it do so with a recommendation that Senate file 108 do pass. It was a standing committee amendment. I ask it be read in at this time.
Would the reading clerk please read in standing committee amendment number one?
Senate file 108, standing committee amendment number one, page two, line four.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I move adoption of the standing committee amendment. Mr. Chairman, it's very simple. It just limits the size of the grant to any one community to $150,000.
Discussion on the amendment. You have all heard the amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Standing committee amendment number one does pass.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I yield to the sponsor of the bill, Senator Bebop.
Senator Bebop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the Senate, I bring to you Senate File 108 as a different option for our senior citizens to look at as they grow older and want to have some help in their living situations. And what this bill does, Mr. Chairman, it provides them an option for what's called the greenhouse. And some of you may have heard this. It's right now there are five communities in our state, Jackson, Sheridan, Lovell, Casper, and Riverton, that are looking at this particular type of a mechanism for them to live in. And what a greenhouse is, members of the Senate, it's a cluster home, if you will, that may have 6 to 10 or 12 citizens living in that home. Within that home, they have kitchen facilities. They have their own bedrooms, bathrooms. If you've been up to WLRC, you can see we have the ICMFR facilities there. It's similar to that in the essence that it's a cluster where the clients stay. This body has seen and talked about this before, and in 2007 they had the Long-Term Care Choice Act, Senate File 89. And what this bill did, Mr. Chairman, was allocated funding through the Department for the Division of Aging within the Department of Health for three communities, Sheridan, Jackson, and Lovell, to look at greenhouse care. Mr. Chairman, our community of Riverton, there's a group called Riverton Cares, and they've been working on this for several years, and they came to me and asked me to bring this bill. And the purpose of the bill, members of the Senate, is to allow them to have funding to be able to proceed with a greenhouse project. Let me explain to you what happens typically. And, of course, for the group to get together, they have to form a 501c3, a nonprofit. They have to get the approval from the IRS to be a nonprofit. They have to raise funding to do this, and they start down this path to try to bring one of these facilities into our community. And what they ran into and what they found out is there's a large foundation. It's part of the Johnson & Johnson pharmaceutical firm that set up this foundation that has a large amount of money that has been promoting and bringing this program to the country. And there was a study done by somebody back east at Harvard, my senator from Natrona County, that said this is a great new concept for seniors. And so we like that idea. And what they've done is they've set up a mechanism to allow people to proceed. But what they have to do is they want a thorough financial analysis done. They want to know that the community can afford this because of the mix of Medicaid and private sector. And the reason we had the $150,000 put in there as a maximum, that's the amount of money that it required to do this study. I will tell you that there's some things this bill does and there's some things that it does not do. What it does not do is in our statutes now we have a moratorium on nursing homes in any community, and there's some miles in the statute. In essence, we just don't build beds to try to have more Medicaid dollars. If you're below 85% in terms of your, I call it certificate of need, it's not that, it's a moratorium, but if you're below 85%, you can, in fact, build more beds, but if you're above that, you can't. So So this doesn't in any way, shape, or form violate that, so we're just not building beds to build beds. It does not include any money for bricks and mortar. This is only a feasibility study program to determine if, in fact, it should happen. The other thing is that, unlike the previous bill that was passed in 2007, those were grants. This requires the communities that want to do it to have some skin in the game. And under the CDBG rules, 25% match is required for them to do it. Now, what it may do, the cost of Medicaid may go up. And you can make a heck of an argument that if you have a community where there's, say, there's like in Riverton, we have 89% occupancy of our nursing homes. So if this facility were to be built, then you don't violate the moratorium, but you will build more beds. And if you build more beds, the people that go into that facility, some of them may qualify under Medicaid, and they may ask for Medicaid payments. Also, what could happen, and this could happen too, is in the existing nursing home, you could have people leave that nursing home and go to the greenhouse home. And when they do that, as I was explained to me by the chairman of our Appropriations Committee, then when they come back to the funding formula for Medicaid, they may in fact show you, well, we now have some vacancies, so you have to pay us for that. So I can't sit here and tell you today that that will not happen. That could very well happen. But what I will tell you is that in order for the greenhouse to work, it has to have at least 50% private individuals. It cannot survive on more Medicaid payments than 50%. In our state today, 82% occupancy is what we have in our nursing homes. 62% of that is paid by Medicaid. So I would submit to you that there are some savings if you have a greenhouse where 50% is private sector instead of the existing situation we have now, which is 38% private sector. And Mr. Chairman, that's essentially what the bill does. We decided to put it in the Wyoming Business Council because we wanted to do the process of the CDBG. I wanted them to have some skin in the game. Those rules were in place. And, Mr. Chairman, I'd be glad to answer any questions. And we do have a second standing committee amendment number two that we could address after. Are there any questions?
Questions on the bill? Senator Sessions.
Mr. Chairman, I guess before I vote on this, I would like to know on the three pilot projects, what's happening with those? I guess what's the mix of private public money? Do they have people that are ready to go in them? I mean, I don't know where they are, and I'd like to know before I vote on this.
Senator Cole.
Mr. Chairman, just a couple questions also. I think I heard the sponsor say only 501c3s can apply for this, and I bring that up because we have a large assisted living project in my little town that has a big project also over in Sheridan, I think it is, and maybe Cheyenne, that's privately run, and it's significant in size. And then the second part of my question, what about hospital districts per se that operate the nursing home facilities? Can they apply also?
Senator Bebo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The update on the status, there were three communities, Lovell, Sheridan, and Jackson, that had requested the dollar. Sheridan is moving ahead, and I think there have been some large private donations that have come into effect, and they are now moving ahead with their project. My colleague from Bighorn County could speak further to Lovell. I think that when they looked into it, I'm not sure where they are and as far as moving forward at this time. But, of course, part of the reason and why we're bringing this bill is because Lovell, Sheridan, Casper, and Riverton, in order to really do it with a greenhouse, need the $150,000 for the financial analysis. So all of them are sort of standstill right now because they can't come up with that funding. And that's why Riverton, why we're here bringing the bill in the first place, to allow them to have the financial ability. As far as a 501c3, you can be something other than a 501c3 and do it. It just so happens that in our situation, we wanted the nonprofit category. The reason we do that, Mr. Chairman, is because we needed to raise some private money, and of course, with the 501c3, it's tax deductible. The other question is hospitals that, in fact, do have nursing homes. If you look at the definition that we have in the bill on page 2 at the top of the page, long-term care facilities, that's the definition that's in the law. I would think that hospitals would, to the extent that they qualify under that definition, would do what they do anyway. We're not changing that, and if I'm wrong, I will be glad to, this bill moves forward, come back and clarify that.
Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, I can only speak to the Sheridan Project at the moment. They have secured land. They have secured some substantial donations. There is a very active board of directors who was headed up by the former chairman of the House Labor and Health Committee from Johnson County, and they are very aggressive in moving ahead with the project.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I can speak also on the Lovell project. I do believe that that was applied for by the hospital district, who also runs the nursing home, and I don't know where that project sits right now. I think they're still in the initial planning stages.
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I can't tell you what's going on with the one in Jackson. Senator Bebout didn't mention that or give you the results. There was a lot of interest early on, but I can't report to you what the status is. Maybe Senator Bebout has more information, but they did a lot of interest early on, but I'm not sure how far they've gone.
Senator Bebout.
Mr. Chairman, the only thing I would add to those existing communities is that the information provided to me was that they are all moving ahead. They run into the same problem Riverton Cares has run into, and that's the feasibility part. They're all raising money. Those communities did have the advantage of Senate File 89, where they were granted the different amounts of money that I spoken of earlier. Riverton hasn't had that opportunity, but as we get to this point, that's where we run into the roadblock.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, we haven't dealt with the Committee Number 2 amendment, have we yet?
Senator Scott, we haven't yet.
This Mr. Chairman, I ask that be read in at this time.
Would the reading clerk please read in Standing Committee Amendment Number 2.
Senate File 108, Standing Committee Amendment Number 2. Delete the first Senate Standing Committee Amendment.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move Standing Committee Amendment 2 to Senate File 108. Ladies and gentlemen, what this does is reduce the funding to $125,000, which is the amount requested by the single facility to move forward. And I guess we have some concerns in the committee. We urge your caution in terms of how we decide to fund granting dollars to expand these facilities. Part of what we do is look at what is the impact not only of this, but on the remaining parts of your budget, how does it relate to other things that we see? Well, these would essentially be nursing home facilities, and as we then pay to have people build more nursing home facilities, then to the extent that Medicaid patients are using them, then we're called upon to fund the rooms. So if you have, right now you have struggling nursing homes, and when they come to us, they're saying we would like to pay our nurses more. In order to do that, you increase the reimbursement for rooms to drive up nursing rates. Then if you they have vacancies, then they'll say, look, we're going to have to shut our doors if we have vacancies unless you increase the room rates. We used to have a certificate of need process. Now we've got some restrictions that you cannot construct more beds unless there is a vacancy rate around the state. Now what's happening is saying, well, what we'd like to do is build nicer facilities for some of our folks. Well, to the extent that you have people that may choose that are paying customers that are non-Medicaid, their insurance or they have their own pay, ability to pay, they move into the new facilities. That becomes a drag on the nursing homes because they lose that payer mix. And as they lose the payer mix, if they go up higher on the Medicaid side, then they're going to come back. They're going to need more money. Then if to the extent that you take Medicaid patients out and we're paying for those and you create vacancies, once again, we come back to pay it. Now, what's interesting about this, among other things, instead of the dollars going through to the Department of Health to administer it as part of a statewide plan to take care of our elderly. It's going through the business council as though this is the way to create jobs. And that's a very fascinating notion to there, because you take the Sheridan facility, for example, to build it, they've gone to get business-ready community grants, either for the infrastructure or for the building itself. So now you're giving them money to go out and design the facility. You go to the business-ready community grant to get money, so you're taking it away from the pool to create primary jobs. Interestingly enough, the business council says, well, these are great opportunities because they're going to create new nursing jobs that are high wages. Why are they high wages? Because they're paid for by the state. And they come to us and they get reimbursement in our nurses. Certainly they are. But to the extent you create more capacity, it gets more expensive and we're called to pay on it. To the extent you give them business-ready community grants as though these are primary jobs, and I submit to you they're not, but maybe they are, depending on your outlook of it. It's not manufacturing. It's not bringing new resources to the state. There are dollars that are being focused to there that are taken away from other areas. So it's a very complicated issue. But what we're going down to is folks saying, well, we can't even get the money together to do the study. Please give it to us. They do the study, they find the need, go back to the business ready community or to the business council and say, now we'd like you to build it. Then come to the JAC in the next year and say, now we'd like for you to pay for it. Very complicated issues, and I submit to you that whether or not you agree or disagree with the creating new the beds, we ought to at least go cautiously. And so what we've done, at least in this instance, it's a re-referral. We don't have the option to say whether to kill the bill, essentially. That's your decision. But at least in this instance, let's restrict the funding to the one facility that wants to do it. But it becomes a very expensive process, and in the end, all of the taxpayers are looking to pay for it. Thank you.
Senator Bieback.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would hope you would defeat this amendment. And let's talk about some communities. I said statewide we have an 82% occupancy rate, but in my community that's about an 89%. And that's an average over a year period. So there are a lot of times in my community where people need to go into that facility, even though they may not want to, just given the nature of it, but they can't even get in. So they have to look elsewhere. So it's a growing demand. As we age, these things happen. And there's going to have to be a place for it. So we as a body, if we're going to make a decision about it, do we look at someplace like a greenhouse that there's really appeal? We've had a lot of studies and analysis. People like this, where we're going to have private sector pay half. Or do we want to continue down that same road of what we've done in the past? Facilities that some would say they don't even want to go into. I submit to you that this is another option of something that's inevitable. The vacancies that we talked about, you know, it's in as far as the moratorium, that's not statewide. That's determined by mileage within an area. So we don't get into a situation like that, as it should be. You could have situations where you could have a place where they could go into one area and overbuild because of the average statewide. The statutes are very clear. It's in an area defined by that local area, and you have to maintain that 85%. Why is it in the Wyoming Business Council? I hadn't thought about the economic side until we talked about it in the committee the other day, and the chairman brings up some good points. But to me, the reason I did it, I thought, what better group to understand and help with an economic analysis to really see if this is viable? If you don't have the private sector money, it's not going to work. And so we needed to do that in that regard. The money's not to design the facilities. The money is to help them to see if it's feasible. If it's feasible, then they go to the greenhouse people who come with grants. And there is a sense of urgency because nationwide they've committed to 50 of these and 38 have already been included, are already in the process, including Sheridan. So they're receiving the assistance of the Greenhouse Foundation to do the design and a lot of other things they do. They still have to do the bricks and mortar. I just think we ought to give these four communities a chance with the 125, one community will get the funding and instead of the four. So I would ask that you defeat this amendment.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, folks. And, you know, if your intention is to create nicer facilities for the aging when there are already facilities out there that have vacancies, fair enough. And that's what happens here. Folks say, well, you know, I would like to have a nicer. In fact, I'd like to be in my house and have people come take care of me in my home. If the issue is we have vacancies and we don't have enough facilities, then I submit to you, this decision does not belong with the business council. It belongs with a methodical treatment with the Department of Health to go out and evaluate what are your vacancies, what's out there, what are we paying for, how are we paying for it. But for those that have been here along, you'll recall that we pay for a national organization to come in and do audits to determine what the reimbursement rates are, and they almost always recommend that we give them cost of living increases. It is very expensive, and if you go look at our budget for nursing homes, it's a lot, and maybe it should be a lot. Having said that, the way you regulate what you're spending is to regulate beds and occupancy, and the way you do that is you do it through a plan that's generally administered by folks that know beds and occupancies and locations. You don't give it to the business council who's sitting there simply, as long as you create new jobs, we're not going to look at the impacts of the state's budget, nor are we going to look at the impacts on the nursing facilities that we're, in essence, paying for. I would urge you that you support the amendment.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I rise also to urge you to support the amendment. And, Mr. Chairman, I was the no vote up in committee, and I guess in explaining why I think we ought to support the amendment, I explained why I was the no vote in committee. The chairman of the Appropriations Committee is exactly right. The way you control expenditures in this area is you control how many new nursing home beds you build. And make no mistake about it, this bill is a bill that's going to lead to the construction of new nursing home beds. Now, Wyoming stands, and I'd not expected we would get into these kind of issues this session, so I didn't bring it down. But the charts I've seen and where we stand compared to other states is that there's about a third of the states that have fewer nursing home beds per capita than we do. And it's... Some of them, it's like Oregon and Washington, it's a significant number, a few of them. And there's about two-thirds that have more. And the national experience has been, if you build the beds, the marketing incentives are such that, by and large, they will get filled. An idle bed is an opportunity, and good businessmen see opportunities and go out and market. And you fill them. This state, we've done, I think, a pretty responsible job of giving people alternatives to the nursing home with the various home and community-based waivers, with some of the various state funds programs that we've got. We've done, compared to many states, a pretty effective job of giving people alternatives. And we've been able to hold our numbers of nursing home beds down. Now, it is true that in some of the communities, including at least one that's interested in this particular project, you're up against, you're over the trigger levels in the moratorium, so you can build new beds. And that's important. We are gradually aging. There does come a time when people need round-the-clock care, where a nursing home gets to be the rational alternative. So we do need that mechanism where we can build more beds, and also hospitals can use that if they want to add a small nursing home facility, as the hospital in Natrona County has, essentially to take care of patients for short stays while they're being rehabilitated from an operation or a fall or something like that. It's classified and licensed as a nursing home, not necessarily what you'd think of as a nursing home, not in the long-term care bed business the way the ones proposed here are. Now, it may be the Appropriations Committee was right in letting the bill go forward with enough money to do at least one of these studies, because if we do need to build new nursing home beds, I would submit to you, Mr. Chairman, these greenhouse projects are very attractive. But I do urge caution, because if we create a bunch of new nursing homes that are more attractive, they will attract some of the private pay, they will cause empty beds elsewhere, they will cause more Medicaid people to come into those as those get marketed, and we will see our Medicaid budget go up and go up and go up. And I think in a way that is not particularly helpful to the individuals involved, I think by and large they're better off in their homes if they can stay there, and that's where they prefer to stay. So I think we ought to be very cautious in this area. Frankly, the committee number two amendments remove most of my objections, caused me to vote against the original bill. And I think we ought to sustain the Appropriations Committee, and the money that's at stake is not the stated amounts here. It's much larger amounts in the Medicaid budget in future years, probably not this coming budget year, but in the years after that.
Question is on Senator Nicholas's motion on Standing Committee Amendment Number 2. All those in... Senator Coe.
I think this is relevant, Mr. Chairman, to the amendment, because for some reason, in the back of my mind, as communities have gone out and expanded their nursing homes like we did in our community, and a significant expansion, the word certificate of need comes into play here someplace, that you have to go to the state, and somebody maybe can answer that. That's the way I think it used to be. You had to go make application. Even if you had a bond issue and you were going to build more beds, you had to go to the state, someplace down here in Cheyenne, and obtain what I think was a certificate of need. Now, if somebody can answer that question for me, that has to do with what a community can do, or if they're at capacity, or whatever it might be.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, the history was there was a certificate of need process. It used to be mandated by the federal government. The federal mandate went away, and we promptly repealed it. And the reason we repealed it was it didn't do any good. It became one more bureaucratic exercise, and the political pressures were such that everybody who wanted the certificate of need got it. And when they didn't, there were claims that, well, they were discriminating against our community. I can remember as a junior member of the Natrona County delegation being instructed by the senior members, now look, this process is bad for Casper. This is too anti-Casper. Let's get rid of it. So we got rid of it. And in our wisdom, we put in this very certificate of need used to cover hospitals and the whole realm of healthcare facilities. We put in a formula in the nursing home areas. It's found in 35-2906B. It says nursing care facility beds shall not be expanded or constructed if the average of all nursing care bed occupancy, excluding Veterans Administration beds, in the construction area is 85% or less based upon the annual occupancy report prepared by the division. And this is a licensing division in the Department of Health. So we've got a formula. It's worked well in keep allowing modest expansion in our nursing homes, but keeping out the big expansions. And it's very important in controlling our Medicaid costs.
Senator Bebot.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to take that one step further, my colleague from Natrona County talked about construction area, and that gets into the localized mileage issue, so you know that it's within a part of your county. It's not statewide. And I will tell you, relative to my colleague from Park County, that Riverton Cares Group came to the Department of Health because of that particular statute and asked if, in fact, they qualified and received permission from the Department of Health to proceed. So nothing in this bill will change the fact that the Department of Health does regulate the beds and the occupancies. It's not the Wyoming Business Council. The Wyoming Business Council is only there to facilitate. because of their in-house expertise, these financial planning grants that we're talking about.
The question is, on Senator Nicholas's motion, on Standing Committee number 2, to Senate File 108, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay.
No.
That amendment does pass. We are back on the bill, and we do have a committee of the whole amendment. Do you want that now, Senator Bebout?
Mr. Chairman, I would move Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1 to Senate File.
Senator Bebout, we need to read it in, and then we'll move with it. Would the reading clerk please read in Committee of the Whole number 1.
Senate File 108, Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1, page 1, line 16.
Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would now move Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1 at Senate File 108. If you look at the bill, Mr. Chairman, on page 1, line 16, after Program 4, we insert existing or proposed new. Mr. Chairman, this clarifies who would be able to do this. In the case of an existing facility like a hospital district where they may want to do it, they would be able to. Or in the case of Riverton Cares, Lovell, Sheridan, that they would also do because it's a proposed one. So I think it really narrows down to exactly what we're talking about, and I would ask for your favorable consideration.
Senator Massey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one clarification on the amendment and the wording. It says a program for new, and which is what we've been talking about, in existing long-term care facilities. So it would go to folks who already are operating a long-term care facility, not necessarily a hospital, you know, which I don't know if that would be classified as long-term care facility or not now that I think about it. But in any event, the purposes of these grants were to encourage folks to go out and think in terms of greenhouse or some other effect and begin the process of building those facilities and for them being new in the community. So by this amendment, are we encouraging the business council to provide grants to existing nursing home facilities in order to expand what they're doing or to do something different? There isn't a lot of criteria built into the language, and so that's why I thought I'd better ask the question.
Senator Bebout.
Mr. Chairman, the purpose of it was not to limit it, and that's correct. An existing facility could do that. And we may need to come back with an amendment that says specifically for this type of facility. However, I think that given the nature where the nursing homes are working now and this type of thing, if they wanted to have a greenhouse type facility, I have no problem with them doing it. And if they needed some planning money, going through the business council to look at the feasibility, as we've talked about, I don't see why that's a problem.
The question is on Senator Bebout's motion on Committee of the Whole, number 1. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay.
No.
That amendment does pass. We are back on the bill. Discussion on Senate File 108. Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Scott's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, you do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 108, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay.
No.
Senate File 108 has passed Committee of the Whole. Next file for our consideration is Senate File 138. Would the reading clerk please read in the
Senate File number 138, sponsored by Senator Scott, Healthcare Professions Database, an act relating to the Wyoming Healthcare Commission. It was referred to Committee number 2, Appropriations, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Senators Massey, Meyer, Nicholas, Peterson, and Townsend, Senator Nicholas, Chairman.
You've all heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Nicholas?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a favorable recommendation for Senate File 138. There is an amendment. I would ask it be read in. And then for an explanation, I'll turn it over to Senator Scott.
Would the reading clerk please read in Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 138?
Senate File 138, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 2, line 14.
Senator Nicholas, are you going to move that?
I'll go ahead and move Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, Senate File 138. And I think it's probably just as easy for Senator Scott to describe it and call for the vote when he's ready.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, Senate File 138 comes to you due to the impending sunset of the Health Care Commission. As the statute now is, the Health Care Commission will sunset on June 30th of this year, and they have one ongoing project that I particularly commend to you as something we need to continue. They have created and are maintaining, originally through a contract, the University of Nebraska, now with a contract, the University of Wyoming, a big database that tells us how many healthcare professionals of what kind we have actually practicing where, and also has information on what the age distribution of those healthcare professionals is, we're likely to look at in the way of retirements. They query them on retirement plans. It's very basic data, Mr. Chairman, we need in order to be sensible in dealing with the whole issue of health profession shortage. We got into it as a result of the special session in 2004, where we discovered nobody had reliable data that you'd count on how many doctors of what kind we had where. The licensure data doesn't tell you because they don't distinguish between the doctor that's licensed in Wyoming and comes in once a month to do LASIK surgery or something like that and the doctor that's in full-time practice here and the doctor that is in part-time practice, maybe is raising a family and practicing one or two days a week. We just don't tell that from the licensure data we had. And the Health Care Commission has created this database. You've all, at the last budget session, I believe, got a copy, hard copy, that they printed of this. It is used by the Department of Health. The federal government has some grants and some special considerations in Medicare reimbursement, which I submit to you is very important to this state, for areas where there's health profession shortages. This data supports the determination of what areas we have that really meet the federal criteria, and frankly, a good part of the state does once you get good data. It provides accurate data as we get to debating, do we need new programs for recruitment of physicians? Do we need new programs to, say, reimburse primary care more? And I mentioned primary care because one thing the database shows is we're particularly short in the primary care area. When we had the tort reform debate, it was a key issue there. Nobody had good data. So that's the ongoing function. If one of these be useful, you have to keep it up. And what the bill does is transfer that function from the Health Care Commission, which is sunsetting, to the Department of Health, lets them continue to use their existing deal they've got with the University of Wyoming till it's time to rebid it. It did require the publication of it at least once a biennium. The Standing Committee Amendment, as I understand it, eliminates that requirement, says they can print one a handbook and assess a fee to cover the cost of printing. I suppose if we want to continue them for the legislature, we'll have to amend the LSO budget to go purchase them. That's an issue for another day. And it cuts out $16,000 of appropriation that was going to go for actually printing it. I believe that's the explanation of the Standing Committee Amendment, and I would urge its adoption.
Senator Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And the couple of components to the Standing Committee Amendment. This is a rather large volume. What we are recommending is that it become electronically available. There is an issue with respect to do we really need to have hard copies out in your libraries? How are people utilizing it? The university who is doing this suggests that we ought to maybe put some resources into making electronic and then going back in the database and making it searchable. What we tasked the university to do, and I'm not sure they've gotten back to the sponsor, was to go back and look into and see what it would cost for them to make a searchable database. In the meantime, we said, go ahead, and if you want to start collecting the fee for the hard copies, collect a fee for the cost of taking over that hard copy provision. On item, which is now new item B on page 3, there's $140,000 for some work to do some data analysis of this work. We were wondering whether that needs to be done next year in light of the University of Washington is finishing up some work, and whether some of that money ought to be made available for making this database searchable. Well, my hope was is that before we hit third reading, we would get feedback from the university that would tell us with respect to how much money they're going to need. We might be doing some fund switching around, but our target is to make this program, knowing it's going to go on long, less expensive, more efficient, get it electronic, get it searchable, and start controlling some of the costs.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman. Yes, we asked the university to give us an estimate of what it would take to make it more searchable. They have not yet gotten back to me. They were supposed to contact the Department of Health once they figured that cost out. They thought they could do it pretty rapidly, but I think we're moving a little faster than they perhaps and are able to move. I hope by second reading to have specific figures, and I think what's going to happen is on that what's now will be subsection B, the $140,000, that the lion's share of that, possibly 60% or 70%, will wind up going to making the database more searchable and therefore more user-friendly, so we're less in need of the hard copy. And the rest will continue to be available so that there's some analyses that are done. It won't be as many, Mr. Chairman, as it had been planned and it would have been done this past year, but we're able to get analyses on at least the highest priority items so that we'll have some kind of a split. So hopefully we'll have that for you by second reading, if not second, certainly by third.
The question is on Senator Nicholas's motion on Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 138. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Opposed, nay. That amendment does pass. We are back on the bill. Discussion on the bill, Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I think we've pretty well explained the bill. I'd be happy to answer any further questions.
Questions on the bill, Senator Coe.
Mr. Chairman, just a question or maybe a comment. Here we are in a supplemental budget session, and I understand they're taking over the responsibilities of the Health Care Commission. I understand all that. But we're talking about the biggest agency in state government. And I'm trying to figure out how come the Appropriations Committee didn't take all the appropriations out. I think there's got to be justification for saying that they ought to be able to do this. You know, healthcare professionals out there, it's no secret that there's a shortage of them statewide everywhere. Why haven't they been doing this all along? And how come with the largest budget in the state government, we're going to go in and appropriate more money to it?
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, they haven't been doing it all along because we had never asked them to. And when we did ask, we asked the Health Care Commission. It's an ongoing function of the Health Care Commission. Would be part, if the Health Care Commission was going to be around, wasn't sunsetted, it would be part of their standard budget. But because of the sunset, they were only funded for 1 year. So they're going away. So somebody else got to do it. When you look at the health department budget, it's large. But where is it? Well, it's in a bunch of institutions. You know, that money needs to stay in those institutions. We need it so that we can continue to do a competent job at Lander and at Basin and the state hospital in Evanston, places like that. So you kind of look at that money needs to be left where it's appropriated. Okay, what's the other big item there? Well, it's Medicaid. And this is useful for Medicaid. You could take this kind of money out of the Medicaid budget, and then the end of the year, when they overspent their budget, you'd have to appropriate more for them next year. That's an open-ended entitlement. So that's kind of a shell game. So it may be the health department budget may be large, but for the kind of money that it takes to do this and do it right, I don't know a real good place to get it.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess if the sole purpose was to go out and identify that you have a shortage and where your shortages are, I don't think we would have supported the bill. I think we would have said, look, it was nice to know this a year or two ago, fair enough. But the data that is derived from the analysis that comes from, I mean, it's one thing to go out and just inquire as to where you have a shortage is. The testimony from the Director of the Department of Health was that the information goes well beyond that. They go out, they survey, they find out where the positions, the vacancies are, underserved areas. Then they use that as to use that analysis to go after federal dollars for assistance when they want to have rural funding formulas and a variety of other areas where it makes a difference, knowing not only having the data, knowing specifically the impacts on the community so that we can do a better job at leveraging our dollars for federal dollars to provide for rural health care. And I think the answer to your question is that it was a convincing enough argument that we concluded that it should be going forward. The Department of Health testified, the director did, and testified that he felt it was a high enough priority that he would put it in his budget, but for the fact that the interim committee had already put the budget through.
Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Nicholas's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rise to report, it do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 138. Please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay?
No.
Senate File 138 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Senator Johnson.
May I have privilege of the full floor, Mr. Chairman?
The floor is yours, sir.
Okay, fellow senators, we have a group hiding up here in the east balcony, so I'd like to ask them to stand at this time. Would you please welcome a group from the University of Wyoming Student Government?
Welcome, students, and enjoy your time in the Senate. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 146. Would the reading clerk please read in the Senate file?
Senate File 146, sponsored by Senator Nicholas. NCAR Supercomputer Funding, an act relating to the National Center for Atomic Spheric Research Supercomputing Center. Atmospheric. It was assigned to the committee number two appropriation. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Massey, Meyer, Nicholas, Peterson, and Townsend, Senator Nicholas, Chairman.
What is your pleasure? Senator Nicholas, could you run the model by us one more time? We're talking.
Mr. Chairman, there is an amendment. We'll go ahead and have it read in. I have to read the bill first.
Would the reading clerk please read in Standing Committee Amendment Number
1? I think I have to move the bill first before we get Mr. Chairman, I move that when the committee of the whole rise of report to do so with a favorable recommendation for Senate File 146, in-car supercomputer funding, and there is an amendment, and we have it read in. Thank you.
Please.
Senate File 146, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 4, line 9.
Senator Nicholas.
Mr. Chairman, I mean, I think everybody's well aware of the efforts for Cheyenne to recruit and bring to Wyoming the in-car supercomputer funding. We recently had testimony that the project is going forward. In the budget that you're coming up, you'll see that there's a $3.5 million authorization to begin some of the development and the improvements to move the site along. We had testimony from folks from UCAR who will be running the in-car facility and saying and they assured us that the project is moving forward. It has national support, and it's going to be, it looks like it's, they may even start turning dirt in the next year or so. It's a pretty exciting project. The financing for the project was to be completed by a Laramie County or a Leeds facility that was going to engage in a revenue bond. The revenue bonds are to be purchased by the state treasurer using funds with the Permanent Mineral Trust Fund. When the treasurer loans money for Permanent Mineral Trust Fund, they have to be secure. There has to be adequate collateral. It's a 20-year amortization. The lease payments for that are going to be pledged will be the UCAR lease payments that they will be leasing the facility from. So UCAR, I think the University Atmospheric Research Group will be leasing the facility. Problem is that UCAR has limitations on their leasing capacity. They can enter into a 5-year lease renewable, obligated to renew, and that extends 10 years. Problem is you need 20 years pledges to get there, and so the we have a difficulty where the treasurer says, I can't lend it to you unless I've got a 20-year obligation secure or pledge. UCAR says, well, I can only pledge 10 years. So the solution was, is the university has said, fair enough, here's what we'll do. We will pledge to the state treasurer that after 10 years, if UCAR does not renew its lease, if they abandon the facility, we will purchase the remaining bonds, essentially purchase the supercomputer. And in order to purchase that, of course, at that time, we're going to have to incur debt. We'll have to go incur our own bonds to pay off the prior bonds. In order to do that, if we wanted to go incur the required amount or to borrow the amount to pay these bonds off, we would have to have a revenue source to pledge, and we will pledge federal mineral royalties, which is the university stream of FMRs. So we're authorizing the university to pledge their to enter into an agreement to buy the building in 10 years if there's not a renewal and pledge their FMRs, which means that they'll have to encumber some of their FMRs from now for 10 years. University thinks it's a good enough project to do it. It's simply an innovative way to move the next stage, Mr. Chairman, everybody, to allow the financing to go forward. It's a problem that exists, and this is the solution. With respect to the amendment, is simply the grammar change. It also allows the bill to get engrossed, which will get the signatures on the cover on as it moves over the House. The having said that, I'd move Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 146. If there's no questions, ask for the question on the amendment.
Discussion, we are on Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 146. All those in favor of Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 has passed. We're back on the bill.
Mr. Chairman, I stand for questions. If there are none, I would call for the question on the bill.
Any discussions on the bill? Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Nicholas's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rise to report, do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 146, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Senate File 146 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next file for our consideration is Senate File 118. Would the reading clerk please read in the file?
Senate File Number 118, sponsored by Senator Escobel, Continuance of Insurance Coverage, and Act Relating to Insurance Coverage. It was referred to Committee Number 7, Corporation Elections and Political Subdivision. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Case, Cooper, Hastert, Johnson, and Scott. Senator Case, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Case.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I would move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the do pass recommendation on Senate File 118. Mr. Chairman, we kind of had to do a rewrite of this bill in committee, so really the bill is contained in the amendment, and I would ask that amendment be read in at this time.
Would the reading clerk please read in Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 118.
Senate File Number 118, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 1, line 2.
Senator Case.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I would move Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 118. Mr. Chairman, this amendment actually brings in some statute where we really think this requirement of this bill should be contained. And for an explanation of the bill and of the amendment, I would yield to the bill's sponsor.
Senator Escobel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the Senate, as was stated, I bring to you Senate File 118. And it's titled, of course, Continuance of Insurance Coverage. I guess one way of explaining this is, you know, we've all heard the expression that you shouldn't change horses in midstream. Well, this bill seeks to address that situation where you do change horses in midstream. I'll explain that in a few minutes. The genesis of this is, you know, what happens when you go from one insurance coverage to another insurance coverage. And basically what happened in this case, because it deals with the statute that deals with group health replacement contracts where one carrier or one employer's insurance contract is replaced with another one. In this case, basically what happened, the genesis of this bill, is that an employee was covered under the employer's plan. During that coverage of Plan A, the employee and his wife both were pre-approved for a particular type of medical procedure. Both parties received original services pursuant to this pre-authorized care. Following the initial provision of services, the employer changed contractors from coverage A to coverage B. The new plan excludes complications or side effects arising from services or procedures or treatments excluded by that plan's coverage. As a result of this, even though the service had been approved by the prior carrier, they were not approved by the succeeding carrier, and this family was basically left in the middle where benefits were denied, and family suffered enormous expenses, ended up going into bankruptcy. I'm not sure if the house is in foreclosure, things of that nature. And this is a fairly middle-class family. They had insurance coverage, all that kind of stuff. It just, you know, they just fell between the cracks. As a result of that, I brought this bill, and Chairman of the committee mentioned to go through several revisions, trying to come up with an adequate, appropriate language that would cover these type of situations. And as a result of that, we came up with the amendment which you have before you, which on page 2 we deleted lines 8 through 14, and we inserted section A, added to section A, which is part of the present statute. The language that we included, and I'll read the entire Section A. Each person covered under the prior carrier's plan shall be eligible for complete coverage in accordance with the succeeding carrier's plan of benefits, which shall include coverage for 90 days for any complications caused as a result of a condition for which benefits were paid under the prior plan within 90 days prior to termination of that plan. Copayment and deductible levels for coverage required under this subparagraph may be reduced to the levels provided by the succeeding carrier's plan. So it does allow for changes in a succeeding carrier's plan, but at least hopefully this would cover those individuals that are basically caught in the middle where they, so to speak, change horses in midstream. That's basically the plan, Mr. Chairman. That's the bill, and stand for questions. If there are no questions, I'd ask for your favorable consideration.
Discussion on Standing Committee Amendment Number 1. Are you ready for the question? The question is on Senator Case's motion on Standing Committee Number 1 to Senate File 118. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. That Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 has been adopted. We're back on the bill. Senator Perkins.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I have a good question for the good sponsor, and that is ultimately, I know we've got some, I certainly am no expert at all in with respect to HIPAA, the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, the federal act, which provides some kinds of portability, and I'm just wondering if anybody's looked at this with respect to the sponsor or someone else, of how this interfaces with the portability provisions of HIPAA. That's question one. Question two is that ultimately it also, in some of these things, it depends on the nature of the plan. And so the question would go to whether or not this really accomplishes the purpose. If this ends up being the type of plan that is basically a self-insured plan where you go back and buy stop-loss insurances to kind of protect your upside risk on events. Ultimately, that's having been through this with the insurance commissioner, those don't really qualify as health insurance plans. And if it's aimed at curing that, the ability of some of the stop-loss providers to actually single out and refuse to cover individuals on a renewal or a transfer, that those aren't covered under health, that's not deemed health insurance by the insurance commissioner and wouldn't solve that problem. And so anyway, those two questions. One is if we got the right kind of plan, and two, if HIPAA, if we're going to have preemption issues with HIPAA.
Senator Astor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In response to the HIPAA question, I did look into that. And I had correspondence back when we were looking at this, because we looked at a couple of different aspects on this. And as according to what I found out, this is basically a contract issue, and that basically that it's in when the insurance companies, when the contracts are negotiated, that insurance carriers are required, when taking the place of a previous carrier's coverage, to provide continual coverage, but it does not require equal or identical coverage. In the case that we're talking about here, the individual's wife had a procedure, and then immediately after, the insurance companies were changed. The new company, when the complication arose, said, we wouldn't have covered the procedure, so therefore we're not covering the complication. And so from the HIPAA information that I found out, that it is required to do this in statute in order to cover this.
Further discussion? Question being called for. Let's see, we're on the bill now, aren't we? Yeah. The question is... On Senate File 118, all those in favor of Senator Case's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rise to report it, do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 118, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Senate File 118 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next file for our consideration is Senate File 135.
Senate File Number 135, sponsored by Senator Bebout, Risk Management, an Act Relating to Environmental Quality. It was referred to Committee Number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Bebout, Cooper, Honeycutt, Larson, and Martin. Senator Larson, Chairman.
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rise to report, it do so with the do pass recommendation on Senate File 135, and at further reading the bill be dispensed with. Mr. Chairman, there is a standing committee amendment, and I ask that it be read in at this time.
Would the reading clerk please read in Standing Committee Amendment Number 1.
Senate File 135, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, that substitute Number 1 be substituted for Senate File 135, and that substitute Number 1 do pass.
Senator Larson.
Mr. Chairman, I would move passage of Standing Committee Amendment on Senate File 135. It is a substitute bill. As we were working this, the amendment became bigger than the bill, and so we thought it appropriate that we have a substitute, and that's all it does, and I would ask you to vote in the affirmative.
Question is on Senator Larson's motion that Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to 135 do pass. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 has passed. Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To discuss Senate File 135, I'd like to call on the sponsor, Senator Bebout.
Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the Senate, as your Energy and Minerals Committee was conducting meetings over the past year, we would have a portion of our meetings would be where we'd have solid waste districts from around the state come and visit us with about their concerns and problems. And what we heard early on was the words risk management and risk assessment. And as you all may recall, there is now an ongoing statewide study to determine, as from input by these solid waste districts, the amount of costs and what they're going to have to do to come into compliance with all of the rules, regulations relative to landfills. And, Mr. Chairman, the more we talked about this, the more I looked into solid waste risk assessment and risk management and said, well, maybe we ought to bring that into the equation through the Environmental Equality Act as a way of helping these solid waste districts deal with this issue and provide a new way of looking at these costs. And, Mr. Chairman, what you'll see, and those reports aren't due until sometime this year, but Fremont County did a preliminary report, and we looked at their analysis as they go into the future and the cost of trying to do what's required under law for their solid waste management, their landfills. They were going to be substantially in the red to the tune of millions of dollars. And one of the things they kept bringing back to me and to the committee was, you know, why don't we talk about risk assessment and risk management? So, Mr. Chairman, I had a bill put together, and initially the bill went into the Environmental Quality Act statutes under solid waste and hazardous waste. And we started looking at that, and that was way beyond the intent of what we were trying to accomplish, which was landfills specifically. And when we went into that, there's just a whole lot of other areas of law and rules and regulations that came into being. We didn't want to go there. That was not what we were trying to accomplish. And that's primarily the reason, Mr. Chairman, why we have this substitute bill, because we really try to narrow the focus of what we're trying to accomplish to landfills, specifically landfills in the state of Wyoming. And that's what this bill does, Mr. Chairman. It provides a mechanism so we will bring into risk assessment and risk management into the analysis of how we deal with our landfills. And just to give an example of why I think it's really important, and we all have landfills in our districts. And if you go to Teton County, well, Teton County hauls their garbage into Sublette County. But years ago in Teton County, they may have had a landfill by the Snake River. Well, obviously, by the Snake River, a landfill has a lot of environmental issues. You go to Fremont County, and you go south out of Fremont County towards Beaver Rim, about 10 miles south, and it's very, very isolated land, and you can look out there, and there's no rivers running by it, and it's land where you're lucky to even be able to drive a fence post in. There's 300 foot of shale, so the conditions there in terms of the environment are certainly different than the ones if you were to build a landfill by the Snake River, or in our case, we have one in land or by the Wind River. Very different circumstances, requiring, I think, Mr. Chairman, a different look at how we do these relative to the risk assessment, which gets into the issue of do we line the pits or not. Mr. Chairman, I will tell you that under the EPA, the EPA rules require that all landfills have a liner. However, they gave Wyoming an exemption that says you don't need to have a liner. You can request a waiver. And part of what this bill does is get in that process to bring risk assessment and risk management in to be able to proceed with whether or not you want to have liners. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to go into the bill. And if you look at it, it creates two new statutes, two new sections, 3511.523 and 3511.524. If you get on page 2 of that, it gets into really what we're talking about. And it says that that may affect engineered containment systems at municipal landfills. The Board and Council, I'm on lines 5, 6, and 7, Board and Council shall give notice and receive public comment on risk assessment. So when we're talking about engineered containment systems at municipal landfills, we're going to say that the Board and Council shall give notice and receive public comment on a risk assessment to that. If you go further on down the line on page 2, line 18, the Council shall give notice, receive public comment, and determine that the revised risk assessment is accurate and adequate under 3511.524B, and I'll get into what that's about, Mr. Chairman. That's where the guts of the bill really is. Over on page 3, we say under C that the Council shall make risk management decisions taking into consideration a risk management prepared by the Department. What we don't want to do, ladies and gentlemen, is have the Department, with all its expertise, prepare a risk management, then it's appealed to the Wyoming or to the Environmental Quality Council, and then they go out and hire it and had done it all over. We have the expertise to do it in-house. We want them to use the risk assessment developed by the Department itself. Then, of course, once that has gone to the Department, they develop the risk assessment. If it's appealed to the EQC, then they turn around and have a decision. You still have the availability to go to District Court through Wyoming Administrative Procedure Act, and that's on lines 11 through 14, subtitle D. Mr. Chairman, if you look at 3511.524, lines 18 through 20, it says the goal of risk management shall be to identify, evaluate, and manage risks, environmental risks, not to eliminate them. And then if you go on pages 4 and 5 and 6 down through lines 12, you can see all of the things that the risk assessment shall explain the Department. It's a very comprehensive list of things we want them to do. I'm not going to get into those. I'll be glad to answer any questions about that. Then we get into the definition section on page 6. We thought it important to define a municipal landfill. In Wyoming, municipalities have landfills, but also some counties may have some landfills. Joint powers boards may have some landfills. And as I understand it, there may be one private landfill in the state. I think that might be in Goshen County. We decided to define municipal landfill, which encompasses all of those, and that's the definition. Over on page 7, we talk about what risk assessment is. It means a report prepared by the Department under 3511.524B. That's the list of all the things that we just talked about that's required. And then the risk management means a decision made by the Council pursuant to what a risk assessment is. So we tell them what risk assessment is. We list all the things we want them to do to get a good risk assessment. Then we want you to make a risk management decision based upon that. It further goes in 3511.109 under the powers and duties of the directors. It further gets into the fact that we're talking about the engineered containment systems at municipal landfills and where the Department will only deal in that area and that area only for risk assessment and risk management. And the language on those lines, including through line 14 on page 8, talk about that. The next part is the issuance of permits and licenses. Once again, very narrow, very specific. We're only talking about landfills. Mr. Chairman, one other thing I want to be sure the body understands. You will note there's a fiscal note that's accompanied this bill. It's a rather large fiscal note. You'll also notice that there's no appropriation with this, and I've talked to the department, and given the nature of this and the narrow scope of it, they're very comfortable to be able to proceed if this bill should become law with risk assessment process and management that should come forward, be able to do it with the people they have in-house. And if, in fact, they see that there's a need, they will go through the full budget process, come back to the through the Joint Appropriations Committee, and in the next budget session we'll talk about what may or may not be needed in that arena. Mr. Chairman, that's the bill. I will tell you that the testimony we heard in the committee was sort of interesting. We had people that on what you would call the business side of this equation supporting the bill. We had the department supporting this bill, and we had several environmental groups supporting this bill. And I think that's good news, Mr. Chairman. It was interesting to see them all come together. And by the way, they all worked together to come up with this language. It's also supported by the county commissioners that look at this as a tool to help them with these huge expenses that these solid waste landfills are facing in the future. I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Senator Sessions.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I don't understand what this does. How do you use this in place of what you do now? So tell me what's being done now in order to permit solid landfills, what the problems are, and then what this would do to replace that. And then I just caught one of your words where you're going to tell the Environmental Quality Council that they can't go out and get their own information, that they have to accept this or the assessment or the study that has been done previously. So I just wondered what's the, you know, how these two things mix and what's the problem?
Chairman?
Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Page 3, lines 4 through 6 was the second part of your question. And it just makes sense to me, and this is, if we're going to have a Department of Environmental Quality that has all this expertise in-house, they do the risk assessment. They know what they're doing. They're doing what the department and the laws and the rules and everything say that should do, they should do, developed by the Environmental Quality Council. Why should they not use that? I mean, that doesn't mean they can't have their own interpretations, but why have someone else go out and do the same thing they've already done? I think it's a duplication. I've heard some testimony that a lot of times the department does a pretty thorough analysis of some things, and the department or the Environmental Quality Council doesn't even look at it. I want to be sure that all the work and effort and time spent on this is utilized by that EQC in making their decisions. That's why we put that in there. I don't want to reinvent the wheel. And the first part of your question, Mr. Chairman, is that's exactly why we need this, because we need to evaluate the risk relative to where we are in terms of the environment through all this criteria. And we haven't done that before. We set up a very stringent criteria as to what we're looking at. And it has to meet that criteria for us to do. We do that risk assessment. Then as we manage that risk, we evaluate how far, what that really means and what we decide to do. And it really boils down to, do we have liners in some cases or not? And we make it based upon a risk assessment and risk management rather than on simply rules that comes from EPA. And everybody says the safe thing to do is put liners everywhere, which costs millions of dollars, which we may not need.
Senator Landon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a lot of catching up to do in the world of environmental quality and landfills, but I do have a couple of questions. One is related to the issue of time and, you know, facing the kind of expenditures that we do on these landfills. I've been told in correspondence by some folks that's going to cost our state quite a bit of money the more time we put in on this. The second thing is, being a relative newcomer, my question would be of the sponsor with regard to what efforts are underway by this legislature to look into landfills. I understand that there has been some work and there's some things underway that might give us a better look at this even before we implement this legislation. Thank you.
Senator Bebout.
Beauty.
Senator Vasey.
Those are good questions. If the body will recall that the Minerals Committee brought forth 2 years ago a study that provided funding for studies for communities to look at their landfill. We encouraged those to be regional. We were way more successful in our encouragement than we thought. So I believe last year we had to add to those funding. So there's that. Each community has looked at their landfill. What we heard back, or what they told us back, that there's a whole range in the state of where landfills are. For instance, in your county, in Natrona, they're pretty far ahead. They have a pretty secure place. There's other communities looking at maybe hauling into that, and then you look at other places that are just barely scratching the, you know, I'm just barely starting. I think why I co-sponsored this bill was the fact that we have that information, but we also need to know on some of these places what the risk is, because it's a huge, huge expense. And we're going to have to fund some of this later on, but it's a huge expense for, say, a small community isolated someplace to have a lined pit. But maybe you don't need that lined pit, and that's the reason for the risk assessment. There's other places that want to just dump it out there, and they have to be told, or there has to be an analysis from the council that this just isn't going to work. So that's the reason for this. And I've got an email too about the time. It's going to take time. Matter of fact, my first reaction was we needed to look at these landfills much like we look at the water development, that every place is a little different place. Some people are going to need money up front. Some people are pretty good shape. But this risk assessment will certainly go a long ways to having the right information. And it won't take any more time, I don't believe.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just quickly, I would like to first of all, commend the sponsors of this bill in bringing this forward. I have five small municipalities, five small towns within my district. I won't take time to name them all, but several of them lay along the Platte River. There's a good deal of concern within these small communities or how they might handle their solid waste. There's a good deal of expense to doing some of the studies, and there's a couple of kind of sayings or cliches that come to mind as I think about this, but you know, one size doesn't necessarily fit all. The another one might be different strokes for different folks. But as I look at those small communities, something like this would enable them to determine what it is that they actually need in order to manage the risks that exist within the communities and the terrain and the environment and whatnot that they occupy. Also, there's a good deal of consideration in regard to economy of scale. The management of solid waste per ton is considerably costlier for those small communities than those other larger communities within my district. Some are examining at this time dump stations where the waste will be transferred to a larger community, being from my community, your community in instance. So I would really commend the folks for doing this legislation, because I think it will really enable those small communities to assess what they truly need to meet the needs that exist specifically to them. And I think it's going to be a wonderful tool.
Further discussion? All those in favor of Senator Larson's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rise to report it, do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 135, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Senate File 135 has passed Committee of the Whole. Next bill for our consideration is Senate File 131. Would the reading clerk please read the file?
Senate File Number 131, sponsored by Senator Scott, Management Audit Study Reading Skills, and Act Relating to Legislative Studies. It was referred to Committee Number 4, Education. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Cole, DeCarrier, Jennings, Massey, Von Flater, and Senator Co-Chairman.
Senator Coe.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move in the committee the whole Risen report and do so with a due pass recommendation on Senate File 131. There is a standing committee amendment, but I'd like to wait until after the sponsor explains the bill to move that amendment. I defer to the sponsor of the bill, Senator Scott.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, the origins of this bill, Mr. Chairman, were in the talk that our Senate President gave us on opening day. And if you recall, he challenged us on a number of items. And one of them was in the education area. And as I remember his specific concern, it was with the number of students that were graduating and then requiring remedial work. But, Mr. Chairman, that set me to thinking. In education, a key is, does the student learn how to read in the early grades? That's what the early grades, grades 1, 2, 3, are all about, is learning how to read. And the student who doesn't learn how to read is going to be behind the eight ball for the rest of their academic career, and in our modern society, probably for the rest of their life. And we've known for some time we've had some problems in this area. That's one thing the YCAS test did show. And in 2001, this legislature enacted a program trying to get something done about that. We require school districts to assess students at the end of grade 1 and grade 2, and where the assessment shows that the students have having difficulty learning how to read, school districts are supposed to go in and investigate why and develop individualized reading plans to remedy those difficulties. And there is a provision that if a student is already under the individualized education plan that is a you have as a result of some of the federal actions, that that's good enough if it covers reading assessment. And you can see those specific requirements, Mr. Chairman, in the statutes on 21-3401. That's where they are in the statutes. They were put in there in 2001. So we're continuing to have problems, and you can see if you look at the recent pause tests, there's a number of school districts that don't have, that have a significant percentage of their students that are not proficient in reading. So I thought the first step was to find out, are the school districts faithfully implementing the requirements that we gave them in 2001? It was a funded mandate, and the certainly when the funds that were contained in that bill have been ongoing and the model, there's plenty of money to get the job done. So it shouldn't be a money issue. The question is, are they doing it? If they are doing it, is it working or not? If they aren't doing it, you know, what's going on? Why aren't they doing it? How many of them aren't doing it? What's the effect of that? So that's what this bill does. It asks our management audit to go in and investigate and tell us, are these school districts in fact implementing the program that we gave them? Classic thing that an auditor, Mr. Chairman, is able to do. It turns out when you look into it that Department of Education is collecting a fair amount of the information they're going to need. That'll simplify the audit process. But I would submit to you there's going to be no substitute for actually going out into the districts and looking and seeing what's really going on. Are the assessments really happening? Are the individualized plans really being done? Are they being followed? You've got to go look in the field, and our auditors do that well. So that, Mr. Chairman, is the basics of the bill. We're telling our Management Audit Committee or Management Auditors to go do this. There were some concerns in the Education Committee about being a little too directive in this area, and they've got some standing committee amendments that address this, and I would yield back to the Education Committee to move and explain those.
Senator Coe.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we did have some concerns about actually putting into statute that the Management Audit Committee will do an audit. And so at this time, I guess I'd ask that the Standing Committee Amendment be read in.
Would the reading clerk please read in Standing Committee Amendment Number 1?
Senate File 131, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 1, line 12.
Senator Coe.
Mr. Chairman, I move the Standing Committee Amendment, ask that further reading be dispensed with, and defer to the author of the Standing Committee Amendment, Senator Massey.
Senator Massey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Standing Committee Amendment essentially makes this permissive or gives the Management Audit Committee the final decision as to whether or not to adopt this study. The language on page 1 says that with the approval of the Management Audit Committee, the LSO or the audit staff will conduct the study. And over on page 2, the work of the Management Audit staff, again, becomes permissive under the direction of the Management Audit Committee itself. And then the list of things to be included in the plan also becomes permissive, saying that the committee shall have the final decision on what's included in the plan. So that's most of the amendment, Mr. Chairman. The only thing outside of that approach that was added is at the very bottom of the amendment on lines 33 and 34, in which an additional subsection of the report was added, indicating that the recommending to the Management Audit Committee that the staff take a look at the ability of the statewide test to assess adequate reading skills in third and fourth grade.
We are on the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1. All those in favor of Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 131 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. We are back on the bill as amended. Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And all in regard, due regard to our colleagues, it seems to me that we're a legislative body. We have members that we designate to go do committee work. But we don't legislate ourselves. That's not the purpose of legislation. We create legislation to tell the executive branch what to do, other branches of government to do. But we simply, it seems to me nonsensical that we would legislate the legislature what to do. And so if I don't like what my colleague in the Judiciary Committee is going to do, let's create a bill to require them to have committee meetings at 4 a.m. in the morning, because I think it'd be fun to see them get up at 4 a.m. in the morning. Motion second and carry. But having said that, folks, in all seriousness, and I understand why the members of the would want to say, look, I want to draw attention to this topic, and let's do it by bills. And then I suppose all 30 of us could put each one of our topics in, make it permissive, and then the Management Council does what? They do it all? They manage their time? What do? We don't legislate ourselves to do things, nor do I think we should. We delegate these tasks to our committees to deal with. If you want to bring the item to the attention of the committee, prepare it up in writing like this, fair enough, deliver it to the committee. They will look at their priorities and assess it. But it just seems a bad practice to put into statute something to say, we don't trust our own members, and now we're going to legislate our committees what to do.
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree with the senator from Albany County. I served, I think, 6 years on the Management Audit Committee, as I recall. The Management Audit Committee does a process. They take the suggestions from the committee, look at them. They always do scoping papers before we assign them a topic. They decide what is within their capability, and I'm not even sure this is within their capability, though they do an excellent job. There are many things that have been suggested that they don't think is within their purview to do, and they bring that back to the committee, and the committee then decides whether they do it. They have a long-standing order of work that they do. Management audits don't occur overnight. They do get in and bring them to the committee. They prioritize them. They sent them. They do scoping papers to determine if they can do it, as I mentioned, and whether or not they have the capability to do that. To assign to a committee that you will do this in statute, I think is clearly wrong. If we want them to do that, do what everybody else does, go to the Management Audit Committee and say, we would like you to determine if this is feasible for the management audit staff, put it on the timeline of other audits that they're engaged in, and bring it back after the scoping paper and decide whether, in fact, that is something that the Management Audit Committee wants them to do. I think legislating this is wrong. And I agree with the comments of the senator from Albany County. Folks, we don't want to go there. There's another way to get there. Just go talk to the Management Audit Committee, ask to get on their meeting schedule, and suggest that this be done by the Management Audit Team. That's the way it should be, and I urge you to defeat this.
Senator Schiffer.
Right now, your management audit team, people we employ, are being audited by a audit team. You know, we'll be stacking audit teams, but anyway, they're getting audited. We've never done that before, but it was time to do it. Now, that is a really intensive process. So, to be very honest with you, your management audit really isn't doing any auditing right now. We're getting audited to see how well we're doing our job. And that's literally going back in to those files on selected audits that we've done over the last 20 years and saying, are they good audits? That's what we're trying to find out. Are we up to snuff? One other item I want to point out, as you're all well aware, we have a new person in charge of management audit. There's a transition time there. Can they do this job? Yes, they could do it. Quite frankly, it would mean suspending all other audits by the time they went through and got the sampling done to make it really good, a good audit. It would take time. You're talking maybe not all 48 school districts, but you're talking this is a large product that you're asking of the quality we demand for a staff of six. They could do it, I assure you, and they do a quality job. But understand what you're asking for. You're asking for a suspension, basically, of all other audit capabilities. We do have one lined up for them to look at, and they're trying to do that while they're getting audited. So scheduling, would be out there roughly, it would be summer before they could even start on it. And the project this size, given our staff, would take quite a while to do. But I think they could do it. But ask yourself, is this really where you want to use your resources? Or do we want to go in and amend this bill? There's no reason the legislature can't contract this work. There are management audit firms out there that will come in and do this and let your audit division continue with the agency audits that we have backed up through our scoping papers. It's a great idea, and there's a number of ways to do it. My question is, are you sure you want your management audit team to do this sort of thing? Thank you.
Further discussion? Senator Scott.
Well, Mr. President, response to those points. I did go down and talk to the gentleman who's the new head of the management audit and asked about some of these things. It did sound like they were very much in flux right now as to what they were going to do next. So this was something that could be laid onto their schedule. And frankly, I did consider some of the options. We could go ahead, we could put a Section 300 in the budget and either ask that the LSO or the Education Committee or the Department of Education or the Department of Audit contract this. It probably cost a good deal more to contract it and get it done outside. And I thought, well, we better be economical this year given what's going on in state government. But that would certainly be a possibility. So I thought the first choice was management audit, and then we could see about, if there's resistance there, we could see about going out and contracting it outside. But our people do quality work. And I thought that'd be the most sensible, the cheapest way to go about doing it. It does seem to me that we need to not lose sight of what's the importance of the subject matter here. You know, this legislature has made education its top priority. We have put a vast sum of money into education. And the one thing I hear time and time again from my constituents is they want to see results. And I think what we're asking for is, okay, are we getting the results? Are the things we've done making a difference? Are they following the things that we've done? Are they being implemented? And we could do it with a management audit. We could do it at a good deal higher expense in some other way. But I think very much we need to get it done. It's part of the basic accountability that we need to get in education. So I would urge us to pass the bill. And if you want to modify it and do it in a slightly different way, that's fine. But we need to get on with it, and we haven't been.
Senator Cope.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I had some genuine concerns before the bill came to committee and actually visited with the committee about it, about putting something in statute like this. And I even had the statutes drawn up and looked at them. And I guess the thing that stood out the most in committee was that after we put the standing committee amendment together, I think we made it more permissive. We put it back to what statute 28.8.107 does in fact say. Paragraph B, the Legislative Service Office, at the direction of the Management Audit Committee, subject to Management Council budget priorities, and subject to general policies established by the legislature, shall, and it goes on to say what they'll do. Now, we did have some correspondence from the head of the Management Audit Committee, and I'll just draw your attention to a couple of things in it. It says here, regardless of the bill, we will continue to pull information together in a scoping paper for the Management Audit Committee, which will more than likely include some review and analysis of DOE's existing information. We've already done some preliminary work with respect to Wyoming's participation in the federally funded Reading First program. What I guess really turned me around about the bill in committee after we put together the Standing Committee Amendment was we had testimony from the department. And they said this is not being done and it needs to be done. We just really don't know where we stand right now with age, this age category in school on reading. And that's why we brought the bill out. I can tell you when I went into committee, I was under the impression myself to myself that I didn't want to support the bill, but I ended up doing so because of the testimony we had. I'd urge that you pass the bill.
Senator Vasey.
Down in that little corner.
I was using the mouse.
Mr. Chairman, I think maybe the cheapest and fastest way to do this would be for the leadership to instruct the individual senators of every district to go into their schools. We get a constituent allowance so we could take some time and really get to the bottom of this. We need to find out why a little kid that's family doesn't speak English can't read. We need to figure out why a kid with learning disabilities can't read. And then we'd come back and we would have it. And we would. So I think that's probably the best way to do it is just for us to go do it. And like I say, we're paid to do that. We get that huge constituent allowance and we could take a month.
Senator Sessions.
Mr. Chairman, on following Senator Vasey, I think that's a wonderful idea. But I'd like to speak to a couple of things. Maybe this is not a bill that we should pass. I do have a question. With all the information and all the data that the Department of Ed collects, why cannot they ask for that growth from first to second, second to third, third to fourth on reading skills in each of those divisions? English is a second language, special ed students, those kinds of things. They should have that data. We put it in statute. The growth of each student was what we were supposed to stand for in this state. And then when you identify the areas that are having problems, go in and figure out why. And I will say this, and it's very sarcastic, but maybe they're taking too many tests and not enough reading is taught given the time within a day. But besides that, I have one more thing to say. After the accusation about the remediation in our colleges, our very qualified secretary went in and I had this whole bunch of questions for her to contact University of Wyoming and each separate community college to find out why their kids, what percent of their kids were going into remediation, what they used to place them in remediation. What came out, I have it all here if anybody wants to wade through and see all of that, but what came out of it is the University of Wyoming does one test, the Compass test. Their scores are very reasonable. I mean, they're way, way down of kids that go into remediation. Given English and reading and all of that, nobody has any, it's just really convoluted. And yet we have all these kids in remediation. And then I ask for the ACT scores that each of those individual institutions use. It's bizarre that the spread of them through there on how, why our kids are going into the remedial classes. So I guess I would ask, in this study on community colleges and stuff, I would ask that maybe they come up with a plan and how they're going to do those remediation scores so we know and we can rely on them. So if you want to see them and want to see them from each college, the whole thing, you can pinpoint, and I might tell you there are some of our colleges, our community colleges, who are not putting near that number in remediation. And some are, and the average in the math came out that way. So I don't know. I don't think we should direct management audit to do it. Maybe somebody should just go to the meeting and ask that they do a scoping paper, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Senator Jennings.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A lot of the questions that have been on the floor right now, we did talk about in committee. We didn't like the amendment shows that you took a lot of the you will do it out of would you do it. So you're coming down to two things that you have to look at. Do we want the study and do we want to dictate it through statute? To go back to the good senator from Cheyenne, when we talked to the education department, they explained that they have a lot of this data on the top level. But to drill down to go into schools and to assess the screening process and stuff that they're using, that a lot of that is up to the district, the principals, and even some levels of the teachers, especially on the first and second grade level. So what this bill's asking for is that you drill down deeper than what we're a lot of the data that we have. We did have discussions on are the tests that are being used good qualifiers for this data. We had yeses and nos out of it. But it's asking for a little bit different kind of data than what we asked the department to do. They were very willing to participate in this, go deeper, whatever, you know, they're probably one of the better departments to just say, you know, what do you want us to do, and we'll go do it. So they were willing to do it, willing to come up with the data. But, you know, whether we want to forge a new path here and start to dictate to one committee from another is the first question. But the other one is, do we really want this data? Has the reading program that we put in before, is it working? We probably should know that. So whether we go up or down with the bill, we still should come back and look for that evaluation. Are we doing good screening? Are the processes that we're using good processes? And that way, when we start in the first and second grade, we don't have to worry about them when they get to the junior colleges. So it's a hard one, guys.
Senator Dockstetter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And respectfully, I didn't hear all of the committee testimony on that, but perhaps the good senator from Casper's hit onto something like this. We've got a good Department of Education. We've got some good schools out there. We've got the resources that are already out there. So why don't we use those instead of going through the Management Audit Committee? Use the resources we have and get the same thing accomplished. Thank you.
Mr. President.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to point out that, and I think most people realize it, but we use the term maybe incorrectly, that this would not go into statute. It's a bill that is in session law. And I think if we, I don't have any handy, but I think if we look through them, it's not that unusual from what we've done in the past, directing ourselves to conduct a study or do something like that. But I just wanted to make sure we all understood that it doesn't go into the session books, that it into statutes, it would be into the session laws.
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me read you an excerpt concerning the management audit. The Legislative Service Office, at the direction of the Management Audit Committee, subject to the Management Council budget priorities and subject to the general policies established by the legislature when in regular or special session, shall conduct audits of agencies. Conduct audits of agencies, not school districts, not departments, conduct audit of agencies. Program evaluations, performance audits, analysis of policy alternatives, audits of accounts and operation of any agency or entity directly or indirectly receiving state funds, and conduct post office audits to determine if the specific recommendation have been done. I hope we get this information. I think we need to do it. My concern is only that we direct through legislation, statutes or not, through legislation that kind of overrules all of this. I don't think it's proper. I don't think it's appropriate. If you want to go to the management council and the management audit committee and request it, then you can look at to see if, subject to their budget, all the other things they're doing. And it could be the same thing. I don't think we need it in statute. It's not what it says here that they're supposed to do. Can we have them do it? Sure. I mean, there's no doubt about that. But I don't think it follows policy. I think it is us directing a committee of the legislature what they can and cannot do. And I just don't think it needs to be in statute.
Senator Scott.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it is subject to legislative priority. That's what we're trying to do, is establish legislative priority here. Now, it is in one of the most important areas that we do, and one of our highest priorities. Mr. Chairman, I would suggest, you know, there's been a lot of concern raised about dictating committees. Now, that has been done quite a number of times over the years. We've told the Education Committee to do recalibrations. I think in Labor Committee over the years that I've chaired it, almost every other session we've had something dictated to us by a statute passed down through here. It's not that uncommon. But I would suggest for those of you that are really concerned about that particular issue that if we act on the Standing Committee amendment and pass it, that I think that answers most of those concerns. That it winds up, I think, giving them enough push so we'll get the job done. But it avoids dictating it. It lets them fit it into their schedule better. I think if we adopt the Standing Committee amendment, we'll solve a lot of those difficulties.
All those in favor of Senator Coe's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 131, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay.
No.
The chair is in doubt. We'll have a... Senator Scott.
Point of order. Was that vote on the bill or the Standing Committee amendment?
That vote was on the bill, I believe.
There's the Standing Committee.
Was adopted.
We already dispensed with the Standing Committee amendment. Is there anybody else who wasn't sure what we were voting on? I mean, I don't want you to think we were voting on the amendment, because we weren't. We were voting on the bill. Okay, division being called for. All those in favor of a favorable recommendation on Senate File 131, please stand. All those opposed, please stand. Pursuant to Senate Rule 11-5, having failed a standing division vote, a roll call vote is required. Would the Chief Clerk please call the roll?
Anderson?
No.
Bebout?
No.
Burns?
No.
Case?
No.
Coe?
Aye.
Cooper?
No.
DeCaria?
Aye.
Dockstader?
No.
Esquibel?
Aye.
Geis?
No.
Hastert? Honeycutt?
No.
Jennings?
Aye.
Johnson?
No.
Landon?
Aye.
Larson?
No.
Martin?
No.
Massey?
Aye.
Meyer?
No.
Nicholas?
No.
Perkins?
No.
Peterson?
No.
Ross?
No.
Schiffer?
No.
Scott?
Aye.
Sessions?
Aye.
Townsend?
No.
Basie?
No.
Von Flatern?
No.
President Hines? Closing vote. Closing. Vote closed. 11 ayes, 19 noes.
Senate File 131, having failed a roll call vote pursuant to Senate Rule 11-5A, is deemed indefinitely postponed. The next... Senator Anderson, Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that the Committee of the Whole rise and report.
You've all heard the motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Mr. President.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk. Oh, excuse me. I'm getting in a hurry. The reading clerk will read. Please read the Committee of the Whole report.
Mr. President, the Committee of the Whole, and I have under consideration...
No. It seems to be off again, reading clerk. Can you use the other one right there? Shows it on. Not.
Mr. President, your committee of the whole, having had on consideration bills on general file, begs leave to report as follows. Senate File 27, do pass amended. Senate File 18, do pass amended. Senate Joint Resolution 4, do pass amended. Senate File 127, do pass amended. Senate File 108, do pass amended. Senate File 138, do pass amended. Senate File 146, do pass amended. Senate File 118, do pass amended. Senate File 135, do pass amended. Senate File 131, failed to pass committee of the whole and was indefinitely postponed. Senator Schiffer, chairman.
Senator Schiffer.
Mr. President, I move for adoption of the committee of the whole report.
You've heard the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion is adopted. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move that the Senate stand adjourned until 10 a.m. tomorrow morning.
Announcements? Senator Geis.
Mr. President, your committee number 5, Agriculture, Public Land, Water Resources, upon adjournment on February 5th, and S-15 will take up House Bill 75, Subdivision Water Supply Study.
Senator Schiffer.
Mr. President, your committee number 3, Revenue, will meet Thursday, February 5th, 30 minutes after noon recess in S-16 to take up Senate File 140, Drug Court Funding, and Senate File 142, Subdivisions, Agricultural Land Taxation.
Senator Von Platen.
Mr. President, your committee number 8, Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs, will meet in 10 minutes, room S-13, to take up House Bill 43, Engross Military Department Leasing Fees, House Bill 46, Engross National Guard Medical Professional Retention Program, House Bill 2, Engross Street Rods and Custom Vehicles, Senate File 143, Marking Structures That Obstruct Flight.
Senator Gase.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, before I make my announcement, may I have a moment of personal privilege?
You may.
Thank you. Mr. President, the Northern Arapahoe Business Council is in town tonight. They're having a reception for all the legislators at the Hitching Post. And yes, it's there, and yes, it's open. And the reception is at 6:30. Of course, this is the governing body of the Arapahoe Tribe, and they'd be delighted to have the legislators attend. Mr. President. Tomorrow morning at 8 a.m., your committee number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, will meet in S-19, top of the stairs, to hear the two subdivision bills, House Bill 9, Engross Subdivision Cluster Developments, House Bill 10, Engross Subdivision Requirements. This is a continuation of the hearing from Tuesday. We're going to get them finished up tomorrow. We'll also take up House Bill 8, Engross Certified Public Accountants Revisions. That's an exciting one, and you really need to get there for that. And House Bill 35, Election Judges. Thank you, Mr. President.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. President. And Senate Appropriations Committee will meet after adjournment, room 204, on this floor to consider Senate File 39, Child Health Insurance Program, Senate File 87, Wolf Brucellosis Testing, and Senate File 99, Career and Technical Training Grants. And, Mr. President, I've double-checked. I think we have considered all Senate files with an appropriation that are either direct or re-referred, and that closes out as our the present plan, unless something extraordinary comes, that we will not consider House bills with appropriations until after the first day that we read the budget, and so we get a sense of where the budget's going to go. I think that's just prudent to get a handle of it before we start which will really put all of the reconsiderations or appropriations after turn or crossover day. Thank you.
Further announcement? Senator Burns.
Mr. President, your committee number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, will not meet tomorrow. Our next meeting will be Tuesday.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. President. I'd like to make an announcement on behalf of the Select Committee on Legislative Facilities. Most of you have received on your desks a little pamphlet with regards to the Wyoming State Blue Book. Your Select Committee on Legislative Facilities over the past year has commissioned an update of those Blue Books, and the Wyoming State Archives will be selling the Wyoming State Blue Book in the Capitol Rotunda tomorrow from 8 a.m. till 10 a.m. and from noon to 2 p.m. Legislators wishing to purchase a Blue Book are encouraged to do so tomorrow. Each of you have received a Blue Book order form and urge you to consider purchasing those. The newest edition of the Blue Book is Volume 5. The State Archives will offer the previous volumes of 1 through 4 for purchase also. Each volume is $25. The total set, volumes 1 through 5, including the newest Blue Book, which takes us up to 2007, the full set is $75. All volumes are also available on CD. So I'd urge you to consider that. It's been a great piece of work, and they will be available for your purchase tomorrow.
Thank you, Mr. President. I just wanted to give a brief progress report. First, I'd like to compliment all the members of the body and the staff. A wonderful job that you're doing with regard to doing the business for the people of Wyoming. Next Monday would be the last day for bills in the House of Origin. On Committee of the Whole, so we have about 3 days left of Committee of the Whole. As near as I can discern, there are two bills up there. There's four bills that have been reported out of committee, and files that have been reported out of committee. Approximately 12 bills still out in committee, but we're looking at something less, I think, perhaps 20 bills. We have 3 days to do that. Now, please understand that those bills that are coming in are those bills that are coming out of labor, primarily, and those bills are coming out of appropriations. Those are important bills. Those are, you know, highly debated bills, and so it's going to take some time. We're going to make it. We're not only on the last lap. We've come around the last turn, and we're headed to the finish in regard to the crossover. I would just like to encourage all of you to really remain focused and focused on the finish. Let's be focused in our presentation. Let's be focused in our questions. Let's be focused in our answers. Let's be focused in our debate. I think that we're going to probably be successful in dealing with all those Senate files that need to be dealt with. So with that, I again compliment you, and I'm going to ask or defer to the appropriations Chairman, and just give us a brief outline in regard to the budget highlights, or I'm going to debate the budget, I'm going to talk about the contents of the budget, but just when it's coming out and those critical dates in regard to next week and how we're going to deal with the budget, so we can start getting focused on that.
Well. Thank you, Mr. President. The as was explained, crossover day is on the 9th. It was my suggestion that we run the budget on the 9th on both houses, and that would reduce in a little bit of the workload coming this direction. If you've seen their committee the whole list, it would have been nice of them to run the budget that day. But they, the House really believed that they needed the whole day for committee the whole. So we're going to start the budget on Tuesday. Tuesday will be the committee the whole reading. If you want to refresh your recollection of how the budget is run, it's in the joint rules, and the mirror amendments are addressed at page 71. Recall that there will be mirror budget bills. We voted on the last changes this morning. The bill will be typed up, prepared. My understanding is it'll be distributed to you before you leave on Friday, so you'll have the actual text. On the committee of whole, there are no amendments allowed. It's just a description and explanation of the bill. The first amendments that you'll be allowed to make will be for second reading. You're required to have your amendments into the staff by 5 p.m. And folks, if you know what your amendments are, get them in earlier. If everybody runs in at 5 p.m., delivers about a request for 100 amendments, our staff will be there till midnight trying to get your amendments out. It's just common courtesy to them to get them out as early as you can, get them to them in the morning, give them the day before, try to get those amendments early. Then on that'll be on, again, Monday, you need to have your amendments in for Tuesdays, or excuse, let me go back. Tuesday's the Committee of the Whole, so you need to get your amendments in for second reading on that same day, on Tuesday, before 5, urge you to get them in earlier. Wednesday will be the second reading. Thursday is a day off, and it's a day off to get everybody consideration. Once again, on Thursday, you need to have your amendments to the staff before 5 for the Friday third reading. And once again, please try to get your amendment requests early so they don't stay up till midnight. And that also gives us a chance on the Appropriation Committee to see the text drafted up of the amendments early Thursday evening. Because on Friday, the only persons that can put in Friday amendments are, and Mr. President, I think there is an error in our books. Right now it says the only person that could put committee amendments on Friday are the chairman of the Appropriations Committee. It was my recollection that we changed the rule to provide that the ranking minority member could also put amendments in. We're checking in on it to see what the status of that. I'm quite certain at least we passed that on the Senate side, and we'll check to see whether it should be in the rules. But in any event, you get your amendments in on Thursday. Then we pick up the amendments that evening, and the reason for having the Appropriations Committee chairman, giving him the capacity to put in amendments on Friday, is just to sit down and take a look at it to see whether or not it's going to balance, and to offer amendments that may shave or cut off or propose alternative amounts to individual requests for appropriations to make sure that when we leave on Friday, we have a balanced budget. That then takes the, we will then pass our budget out on Friday. It gives the staff a week to prepare the text, or actually they go in and compare the mirror amendments from both houses, try to reconcile them. We will bring the conference report back on Monday the 23rd, and or the 24th, depending on the president's and majority floor leader schedules. We have it scheduled that we'll do the conferencing on the budget on about the 27th, be the Friday. We wait late for a couple reasons. One is because in the conference, among other things, that's when we have to do our budget balancers. If you think about it, we have to move funds around to accommodate the appropriations that... Okay, actually, I'm told that our rule did not pass, so the printed rule is right. I apologize. It should have done it, but maybe we'll take another change at that. Our staff says, Mr. President, that the rule that we adopted on our side that would have given the ranking minority member of the Appropriations Committee the opportunity to put amendments passed on the Senate but not in the House, and that's why it's not there. So they'll just have to work with us to make sure that any considerations that you have are represented. With respect to what I was talking about is that we kind of lay it back for a couple of reasons. One, we have to have a balanced budget. We have to know what the budget balancers are between the budget reserve account and the general fund. And we want to wait as long as possible to get that conferencing done. We then conference on the bill, come back to the House to get confirmation, and with the hope that we would have a final budget bill to the governor by Monday on the, would be the first day of March to make sure, or the second day of March, to make sure that the budget bill gets to the governor in time that he's required to bring any vetoes back to us so that we can consider veto overrides. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that's the process.
Any questions on the budget process?
That...